want you to sign away your rights so you won't get any royalties for this.
What do you want me to say?
Here or here. This.
Here's okay?
Yeah. Good to go. Oh, great. I didn't even have to do that. Yeah, I'm really delighted to be here today. I did attend one of your conferences before in Chicago. You had a joint conference with the Midwest Archives Conference, and I was being an archivist then, so that worked out pretty well. And that was great because there were a lot of sessions on 19th century brass bands. You can't hear me?
I'm not hearing you too well.
You're not hearing me too well?
No, I'm not hearing you too well.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe I need to talk louder.
What was that?
What?
There. Now I hear you.
Now, okay. So don't get near exotic electronic devices very often. And I brought with me Mr. Abe Torchinsky, who is the foundation of the Philadelphia Sound. He was principal tuba of the Philadelphia Orchestra from 1949 to 1972. Before that, he was in the NBC Symphony under Toscanini, and prior to that, the National Symphony Orchestra. He played with the Isham Jones Orchestra when he was in high school here in Philadelphia, and he also marched in Mummers' parades. And for a number of years, Mr. Torchinsky and Henry Charles Smith hosted a radio program on one of your public stations.
You know, I hate to say it, but I'm having difficulty hearing her. One of the problems of being a brass player and in an orchestra before Philadelphia, the NBC Symphony, raises hell with your hearing. And I don't know, am I being heard pretty clearly here? But she's the only one that I'm not hearing too.
Let me suggest that Carol's in here and I'll run the slides if you tell me.
Oh, okay. All right.
Is that all right?
That's okay.
You just beep when you want me to.
I was not hearing you at all.
No. Okay, well, I told them you played with NBC and with Isham Jones.
Yes, Isham Jones is a long time ago. I was a kid. I played bass, string bass, and I had a tuba with me if he wanted me to play. For those of you might be interested, how I came to Isham Jones, he was playing in Wildwood, New Jersey on the famous pier. I think it was Hunt's Pier, if I'm not mistaken. And his band, he was very cheap. And his band, which had people like Woody Herman in it and all sorts of big names in the jazz field, walked out on him. I was working with a band over at Wildwood Crest Pier, a summer job. And someone told him about this terrific band, bunch of kids. The leader of the band is long gone. He came over and listened, and he hired us. And we went on the road a whole summer, part of the fall, until I had to go back to school. And that was my experience with Isham Jones. And yes, he was cheap, but must have been around 1937, 36, around then. I don't. It's so long ago, I don't remember it.
What did he pay you?
What's that?
What did he pay you?
What did he
pay you?
I'm sorry.
Pay. How much did he pay you?
Oh, God. I'd hate to tell you. We were making what I thought was a fortune, about $25 a week. And it was a lot of money, because my father had a tailor shop in Philadelphia, and I remember he thought he had a good week if he made $40. So I guess I thought I was rich. But, you know, that was the music business in those days. But what else do you want me to go on?
Okay, well, next I was going to say that the tuba player has a unique perspective in the orchestra, because we're usually able to see what everybody else is doing, except those directly in front of us, but we can read their body language, so we know if they're particularly upset or happy. Tuba players also had opportunities, especially before the 40s, to record in a number of genres. because double basses didn't record very well. So as he's describing playing with Isham Jones, Oscar Lagasse of the Detroit Symphony was with the Orange Blossom Orchestra, and that was true of many tuba players like Joe Tarto. There was a great deal of money to be made if you were good at imitating the double bass on tuba. And you'll see brass bass on record labels. So, of course, I'm expecting a lot of comments from this audience. But I will say that the Philadelphia Brass Ensemble recordings represent some of the earliest modern brass ensemble recordings on a major label. Mr. Torchinsky's teacher, Bill Bell, the New York Philharmonic Brass Quintet, made an album about 1955. But it was on Golden Crest, and that wasn't really available at your local record store. And before that, of course, there are the brass solos with Herbert L. Clark, Jules Levy, Arthur Pryor, but they're mostly solos. And with the exception, as I said, I'm expecting some comments on this, of Herbert L. Clark's Victor Quartet's scattered recordings made pre-1920, there aren't many examples of brass chamber music on recording. The Chicago Symphony did record some quintet and brass quintet and woodwind quintet, and they had some teeny little copyright problems, so those were pulled. But the modern brass quintet literature only really came about after these early Philadelphia Brass Ensemble records. These were all transcripts, mostly by Robert King, and it wasn't until the Montreal Brass Quintet started doing commissions that there was much besides the quintets of Ewald and Ramso. So, and I'd like to say that the influence of the brass ensemble is not only through the recordings, which are still on the must-have lists of teachers of brass instruments, but the members themselves, through teaching here at Curtis and at other schools, they directly taught many students personally, and the students of those students. I've taken lessons from one of his students. And this recording, I'm going to hold that up. This is the suppressed Torchy Jones Quintet recording. And I have a quote here from Henry Charles Smith about this. He said, "We masqueraded, not very seriously, as Gil Johnson, Cy Rosenfeld, Mason Jones, Hank Smith, and Torchy Jones," was Torchinsky's name. "A man named Frank Hunter did the arrangements, and it was basically the brass quintet plus a rhythm section of three, a drum, bass, and a guitar." And he goes on to talk about somebody that's made a few CDs from this. He said, "It still sounds very well to my ear. It's nice playing, it's relaxed playing, and the arrangements were tailored to us. We had a contract to make multiple records of this sort through Columbia Records, and Ormandy got wind of it and thought it was beneath our dignity and had the project canceled. So we only made one recording, and shortly after that, it was withdrawn from the market. We felt the boss had something to do with that, and probably our mistake was not asking him to conduct." If you want to. And so if you'd give me your comments on that, and then I'll have him play a couple cuts.
Well, do you want me to tell this story on the Torchy Jones record?
Mm-hmm.
This Torchy Jones record, it's a fascinating story. I got a bright idea in my head back around, I guess, was actually about 58, 59, that if you took what we used to call a legitimate brass quintet, which is kind of a joke to me. I mean, come on, musicians are musicians. And if you did that and got a good arranger and wrote stuff for the brass quintet, it would be something really was way ahead of the Canadian brass. I don't think any of them were born around that time. Well, we got a hold of, the first thing happened, we contacted Columbia, and the A&R man, who is now retired, also old, he said, "I have a young man at the University of Pennsylvania who he's a drummer." He said, "He's written some terrific arrangements." Well, we had a recording session with the orchestra up at the old Broadwood Hotel here in Philadelphia, and he brought this young man up with his arrangements. We looked at them, and we thought, "You got to be kidding." They were amateurish. The young man's name was Jimmy DePriest, the conductor, Marian Anderson's nephew. Well, that took care of that. And incidentally, Jimmy and I have been good friends over the many years since then. But in any case, I recommended Frank Hunter. His real name was Frank Hunter Mark. His father was the conductor of the old steel pier orchestra many, 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 many years ago. Frank was an incredible talent. And he wrote all the arrangements for this group. The A&R man, whose name was Howard Scott, you may or may not know him, didn't like some of the arrangements. I thought we should start out in a very beautiful symphonic kind of assignment, then break into swing. These things were doctored. They turned out okay. Then came the name. I thought it should be called the Philadelphia Brass Ensemble, whatever. Howard came up with the Torchy Jones Brass Quintet. Torchy for my nickname, and Jones for Mason Jones, the horn player in the group. And the only thing that I thought was pretty darn good was Catch the Brass Ring. The record was born. We recorded in an old church on 3rd Avenue, up around 3rd Avenue, and I think around 30th Street in New York, I'm not really sure. And the thing that really is fascinating, we sat in a line, a long line. That's the way it was recorded. And they had the rhythm section, the drummer and the bass in front of us, and a guitar player. This was 1960, I think, or 59 when it was recorded. The potential was so great, and none of us were really interested in being so-called, quote, jazz musicians, unquote. We were very happy playing in the Philadelphia Orchestra. We were offered a week at Lower Basin Street East, I think it's called, in New York, $5,000 for the week, which was a lot of money for a group in those days, and we refused it. Look magazine wanted to do a spread on us. They sent photographers down to Philly. I don't know if any of those pictures flashing behind me.
I don't know if I have that one on there or not. Okay, that's the back.
There's a picture of...
No.
Sorry. That's one of our early... That's a story in itself. There was a picture of the groups sitting around a tree. A very commercial thing. I'm up in the tree, holding a tuba. I couldn't even lift the tuba today. Then I had to get up into a tree with the darn thing. And it was really a great commercial picture. Everything was going along fine. In those days, if we bought records at a wholesale price, if we went to a wholesaler, we received royalties on the suggested retail price. If you got the records, like this one I notice is a demo,
yep.
Got nothing. I bought, I guess it was close to $500 worth of records, because the guys in the quintet said, if you're going near the wholesaler on your way home, stop in and get so many for me. It was about $500 worth of records at a wholesale price, which meant whatever the retail value, we would have gotten royalties on it. That was done before the Christmas season. In the interim, Ormandy got word about this record. We tried to hide it from him in every possible way. We never used the word jazz. That was a dirty word in his dictionary. So our former concertmaster, who's still living, Ansel Brusiloff, quite innocently went up to see Ormandy in a summer home in the Berkshires. And he said, "Maestro, have you heard the record that the Brass Fellas made? Wonderful record. Jazz." It's the minute he said jazz, you could see the smoke clear down to Philadelphia. He had enough power in those days. He had the record pulled off the market. He had the A&R man fired from Columbia, and this thing never existed. This is the best part. The following I think at the end of February, beginning of March, when the royalty statements came out, we sold one record. Now, there's no way of proving that, certainly in those days, but it was pathetic. It was absolutely pathetic. But in any case, that was the end of the Torchy Jones. The only thing good that came of it became a collector's item. And there it is. Are there any questions on it? Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
He did not want anybody to remember that he had ever recorded anything that was not classified.
Well, more interestingly than that is right after this record was pulled off the market, we did a series of records with the Philadelphia Orchestra. The Pink Panther, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I mean, I can go on. I can tell you records that we made. That didn't matter. And believe me, we junked through those records. There were mistakes. Nobody gave a damn. Just play. Get him out. But he was. I still think to this day, and I'll probably think this until they put me in the crematory, that had we offered him a share of the royalties, he would have maybe gone along with us. But none of us were that smart. That gentleman back there. I'm sorry, what was that?
He bought it. He bought that record you sold.
Which?
The one.
I had that record. I was 11 years old and I was 74.
You have this?
And I bought that record. That's a new record?
You have a collector's item.
I'll have to check, but I didn't hold it.
Well,
I hate. Well, interestingly, the group, it's kind of sad. Gil Johnson, I think, was one of the greatest trumpet players that I ever worked with. And believe me, I worked with some pretty darn good trumpet players. And Gil passed away, died of cancer not terribly long ago. The only one, Seymour, the second trumpet player, had a horrible stroke, and he's confined, very much confined. The only ones that are left are Henry Charles Smith, who gave up music and became a conductor. And then there's me, of course. I'm still around. Mason Jones is still around. He's older than I am, and I'm 83. Mason is probably about 85, and in reasonably good health.
Yes.
Cassian, did you say trumpet?
Yeah, who collects the ornament. There are three of us that are major collectors of that ornament at that period, 20 records.
What year was this?
Blackburn.
What year was this?
Blackburn.
Yeah, Roger Blackburn's the other collector of the ornament stuff. So anybody that cares about that, you can go after the New Emerald Graphic and get that. And as a follow-up, in 2 issues later, included were No. If you ever find any records of Ormandy, let me know. I ain't not buying them from you.
Okay, could we get to the... Yes, I was hoping I would get a chance to play it. Could I have number 5, please? Spring Love, or at least a bass and string blues. Since that album got the engineer fired,
even the record doesn't say anything about percussion. Is that added later?
The rhythm section was there with you, weren't
they?
Oh,
rhythm section. The rhythm section was not picked by us. I hate to say it, but we weren't too happy about the rhythm section, with the exception of the guitar player Art Ryerson, who was a I'm not sure if Art's still alive, but he was a very, very busy commercial guitar player around New York radio stations in those days. But the bass player and the drummer were picked by Howard Scott, and we weren't too pleased with the rhythm section, but what can I tell you? That's what we got, and that's what we had to do with. I'm sorry?
Were they with you when you recorded it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, it was there. We tried to do our best with them. The only thing that I asked Howard Scott, I said, please, don't get a piano. I thought that was going to be just a little bit heavy for what we were trying to do. And he finally agreed to that. But, you know, what can I tell you? That's a way. In fact, in the beginning, we didn't even want to use a rhythm section. We felt we could do it without a rhythm section. But, you know, the powers who be, they got more powers than the players. I'm sorry, I'm not hearing too much.
You said when they did something with Hazel Scott, they added
with
percussion later.
Oh, not us. No, we did everything right there.
Are the arrangements still in existence?
That's a very good question. The arranger is still very much alive. Frank Connor is a very good friend of mine, lives up in Bucks County, and he gave us... Everybody had a complete set of arrangements. I lent my set to one of my students. Goodbye. I have no idea where it is. I don't know if they're in existence. I really don't. There might be a set somewhere.
How long was the album actually on the market?
I'm sorry?
How long was the album on the market?
Months. We recorded it, it was in the winter, because we ran into some snow. I remember that. And so let's say less than a year. It's a damn shame, but you know, the power that they had in those days was unbelievable. Normandy was a big moneymaker for Columbia. I mean, we recorded with the Philadelphia Orchestra. You wouldn't believe how we record. When I hear the young musicians today scream about doing a recording session, it might go 4 hours, 5 hours, you know. You're killing us. We used to do 8, 10, 12-hour sessions, and they would go on and on and on. There was one period where we did 13 weeks in a row without a day off. Every Sunday was recording. It was unbelievable. And then I think the greatest thing was they had no regard for religion. Some of our fellows were very concerned about recording on Palm Sunday. Jewish fellows in the orchestra were concerned about recording on Passover. We just recorded. We made pretty good money. I mean, we thought it was, but of course, Ormandy was making very good money. And that's what it was in those days. Worked hard. Any other questions?
Okay, I'd like to go on to the next recording. After losing the A&R man on this one, the next recording that the Brass Ensemble did was the Glorious Sound of Brass. Oh, great. This is an authentic library copy of the album. You can see by the book pocket on the front, my copy's in Michigan and I'm not. So this album received a Grammy received a Grammy nomination for the Best Classical Instrument Ensemble, but they actually won the Grammy for the Best Engineered Recording. And this one, since it was out on the market, there's actually reviews of it. The 1967 review in the New Records said that... much of this music will be new to most listeners, but not difficult because most of it is old. There's no doubt about the technical perfection on both the part of the musicians and the engineers. This one is a real ear popper. While in High Fidelity, they had a reviewer who didn't really appreciate instruments with valves, who said, "Well, to any purist, it is sheer barbarism to play music of the Renaissance and Baroque periods on anachronistic instruments which completely traduce the original, far leaner, whiter, and more astringent tonal qualities. The Philadelphian virtuosos might take to heart the musical equivalent of an ancient injunction, renter unto Wagner that which is Wagner's." But, when the new recording came out... it was combined with, which is what I'm going to play, this was combined with a 1962 recording of the New England Brass Ensemble with E. Power Biggs, and the reviewer says, "The comparison is starkly unusual. Renaissance recordings by the Philadelphians are absolutely stunning. Brass ensemble sound just doesn't get any better than this." Comparing the rich harmonies of Providebam Dominum by Orlando de Lazis with the magnificence of the legendary Philadelphia Orchestra brass section and resonant town hall results in truly glorious sound. The recording or remastering blends the elements superbly, providing a cleansing wash of pure brass sensuosity. The trumpet sound of Gil Johnson and Seymour Rosenfeld is remarkably well matched, and the breadth and depth of Abe Torchinsky's tuba sound provides a firm foundation. And this reviewer went on to make some not quite so flattering sounds about the New England Brass Ensemble. But I'd like to play first a Petzl Jig. The Orlando de Lasses. Lovely minute of quietness before I'm sure we'll be playing louder things later.
If you want to know about this next recording, that's a fascinating story too. Andy Kazin was the A&R man for the Philadelphia Orchestra. Some of you may know Andrew Kazin, I don't know. I think he's still associated with the Philharmonic, if I'm not correct. But in any case, I went up to him and I said, Andy, how about recording the brass quintet? And his answer was, you want me to get fired? I mean, you know, the scare tactic. I said, no, let's record something really legit. I mean, come on, something he can't argue with. I said, how about some Baroque stuff? Came up with that glorious sound of brass. The funniest part of it, after it was recorded, it was quite successful. Won a Grammy for Best Engineered. Gil Johnson's wife heard it, and Gil said, how did you like it? It's a nice piece. All the tunes all sounded alike to her. But it was a pretty successful. I understand that that's available on CD now. That's very much available. But the only record that's not available, of course, is Torchy Jones. But the other records are all available on CD. Did you want me to go on?
Well, I'm going to go on. I was going to go on to the Gabrielli now.
The Gabrielli?
The Gabrielli.
That's my favorite of all time. The Gabrielli was dreamt up by Andy Kazin. That was his baby. He came up with it. And the logistics of getting three brass groups from three major orchestras to come into Philadelphia to record. We recorded it Broad and Race, which was they called a town hall in those days. It's a parking lot now, parking garage. And it was a miracle. It was an absolute miracle. We all got there. It was on a Friday afternoon. We did the entire album in 3 sessions. We got there, and there was Bud Grant, who was one of the, you know, Bud? I think he still works for Columbia, if I'm not mistaken, or whoever, Sony. He had a big microphone stand and a sign on the stand. He said, "Welcome to the home of the new Columbia recording, up to your ass and brass." I think that was the most, it was unbelievable. Well, we sat down and we recorded. 3 separate brass groups. That one, is there a picture there of that? That's pretty much the way we recorded, only except.
Yeah, I've got another picture that shows the setup, yeah. Oh, there's a close-up. Yeah, and there should be one that shows there.
That's the way we recorded. The only difference is we hired, in fact, most of the recordings that we made after Torchy Jones, we hired one of the members of the Philly Orchestra, Dee Stewart, who teaches in Indiana, to play euphonium. And Glenn Dotson is playing euphonium for the Chicago group. He then joined Philadelphia as principal trombone after that. We got through the 3 sessions, and a lot of the fellows had to get back. They had to get back to their various jobs. Those of us that remained headed down toward the Academy of Music in Philly, and we stopped in a place called the Brass Rail to get some lunch and a beer. We were good. And all of a sudden, somebody said, "Hey, we never tuned." And Bud Herseth, the principal trumpet in the Chicago, he said, "Can you imagine if it were 3 woodwind quintets? The oboes would still be fighting who gives the A." But we never tuned. And of course, Ormandy wanted to know who the conductor was. And it was our greatest pleasure to say there wasn't any conductor. The way we did it, you know, the trumpet player, whoever, there was the lead in that particular piece, nodded his head and off we went. And I think it's a terrific recording. It won a Grand Prix du Disque. It won a Grammy for Best Chamber Music of that year. And it was nominated for Best Album of the Year. Best Classical Album of the Year. And I thought it was pretty damn good. And that is available on CD also, thank goodness. So, wonderful, wonderful recording. And something Ormandy couldn't do a damn thing about. You may think that I sound like I hate Ormandy. I didn't. I think, you know, I like to give the man a lot of credit. I really do. He had enough brains, enough savvy, that he did not mess around with what Stokowski created in the Philadelphia Orchestra, and that was the sound. I mean, the sound of the Philadelphia Orchestra was lush. The only thing that was wrong with Ormandy, he was such a money-hungry character that he let little mistakes fly by, and it got to a point. I remember one instance where we were recording up at Town Hall. I don't even remember the piece, but whatever it was, there were some glaring mistakes. Gil Johnson picked up his trumpet and just blew blah, 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 all over the place. They had to stop the recording. It was the only way we could get the guy to stop. But, you know, he was an unbelievable character. But look, he did keep the orchestra, the sound of the orchestra going. And that was important. Any questions?
Okay, well, I'm pleased to note that on April 10th, I was going for a walk. I had my headphones on. I heard Carl Haas praising this album. at which he was apparently under the impression was recorded in San Marco Cathedral instead of Town Hall in Philadelphia. And I said, well, hello, Carl. Right pew, wrong church. And I'm sure the music is... The music is so splendid that, of course, it couldn't be a humble town hall in Philadelphia. It had to be in a cathedral somewhere. But
he thought it was recorded in San Marcos?
That's what Carl Haas said. I don't know. It's another record, but he played.
That would have been nice, you know?
Yeah, it would have been very nice. It would have been very nice.
I mean, nice to go over there just to make a record, but I'm afraid it didn't work that way.
Yes, well, in the new records, you got a very good review. Astounding, brilliant techniques and sensitivity are the hallmarks of this fantastically handsome recording. But in High Fidelity, the reviewer again goes on about anachronistic instruments and says, even worse, the modern instrumental timbres are markedly anachronistic, where trumpets take the part of the original cornet, zinken parts, and intolerably so, where the lower voices are entrusted to flatulent 19th century euphoniums and tubas. A modern reviewer in the Trumpet Guild Journal in 1997, on the other hand, says, 27 years later, the re-release of this historic recording maintains its significance both from a musical as well as an historical perspective. This recording comes as close to the definitive recording of the music of Gabrielli as we may ever hear. The music of Gabrielli has never sounded so good. This is an important album. Buy it. If you play it. So this is the Canzona per Sonare number 2, which every brass player in the audience has played.
Another thing with that recording. Thank you. There's another thing with that recording that really has a very soft spot in my heart. The three tubas were, of course, myself, Arnold Jacobs, Chicago Symphony, and Ron Bishop, who's still playing with Cleveland. Arnold was my first teacher, the very first serious teacher that I had. He was... I think he was playing with the Indianapolis Symphony in those days. And he was making a lot of money. I think it was $65 a week. It's really something. And he used to come back to Philadelphia, and I would go down and take a lesson from him for $1. I mean, it was really something. He was a wonderful player then and a good teacher. But it was a thrill, you know, playing with alongside this man. And another thing with that record, I don't think that Carol mentioned the, what would you call it, the booklet that comes with it?
Mm-hmm.
Andy Kasten came up with a terrific a chart.
Yeah, if you...
Is that?
Yeah, we've got a scorecard, as he said.
You can sit and follow that chart, and you know exactly who is playing.
There should be, maybe it's back farther, there should be a...
No, that's a cover.
Maybe I must copy the wrong file. I'm sorry, I copied the wrong file.
Well, anyhow, it's the little booklet that comes with the record. You can open it up and follow that chart, and you know exactly who's playing. And that's a wonderful thing.
And their physical location, so you know who's in the right speaker and who's in the left speaker and who's in the center.
But it was, and of course, I don't know, do you mention the Christmas record in there?
Yeah, but I was going to talk about Hindemith, but we could talk, the Christmas record.
That was our big money maker. And the last record that we made, well, we did the Hindemith, was that
right? Yeah.
But the big money maker we made, and at one point I was ready to become a Mormon. We did a series of, we hired 20 brass players. Well, there were 20 all told. And we went out to Salt Lake City and recorded a whole mess of music, Christmas music, everything. And they came out with a series of records. And that's been a big moneymaker. We're still collecting royalties every year from that, those records. But I must tell a funny story about that one. We hired a conductor, Bill Smith, who was the assistant conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra. He came out, and he would rehearse this big ensemble and the Mormon choir. And when he finished, and we were ready to record, Richard Condy, I think his name, the conductor of the Mormon choir, would step up, do whatever he wanted, and we just played. The best one of all is when we did We Wish You a Merry Christmas. Now, anybody can conduct We Wish You a Merry Christmas. All you have to do is, we wish you a Merry Christmas. We boom, 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 boom. Just do that, that's all. He got up, was rehearsed, and he got ready. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish. By the time we got through, he was so tired, he was gone. We just kept playing. It was very interesting. But they were good records. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, well, I was going to talk, I think we've got, what, 5-10 minutes?
All right.
15 minutes. Oh, boy, it's comfortable. Well, I was going to talk about the last album that this quintet, or four of the quintet, recorded as singles, which were the Hindemith Sonatas. And Andy Kasdan, who had produced these other albums, had been working with Glenn Gould for quite a while. And Andy's even written a book about his time with Glenn Gould, which is called Glenn Gould at Work, Creative Lying.
He was something else. I mean, I think, and I know I can quote Mason Jones too, both of us agreed, this was probably a highlight of our musical careers. This guy was, he was unbelievable. I was already out of the orchestra. I had accepted a job as a professor at the University of Michigan. I was very happy. I didn't have to practice. And it was really, you know, it was really kind of a picnic. And I got a call from Andy Kasdan, how would you like to record the Hindemith Sonata? And I, wow, you know, I was kind of taken aback. He said, look, you'll probably have a year. So I said, okay. Well, I started practicing, and I mean practicing like I hadn't practiced in years. And I finally got a call from Glenn Gould. He went through the entire sonata by voice, over the phone, piano part, tuba part. And I couldn't believe what he was doing. It was agreed that we would do this. It was a Labor Day weekend, a gorgeous week. We were told to stay in the something. Got a call, and he said, I'll be at the hotel. Got a call, and he said, I'll be 7 o'clock this evening. My wife went, drove up, well, not, yes, by the Eaton, a lovely Eaton, talk night. He used his voice into the horn, and was wrong, written the way it says in the piano. So he started to play a note, which is a note, and he changed it. And I was sure nuts to read me.
Yeah, writes about Gilgen. The Trump visiting Ontario court and having to deal with foreigners who he was seeing in Canada. The woman was virtually held prisoner until he was in the employee of CBS in the United States and would be paid by them. Well, he apparently sat there for hours and hours and hours. And as the hour for recording in the Eaton Auditorium drew nearer, his anxiety increased and his temper flared at the Ontario immigration officials. This didn't help. After being detained for hours, he somehow was able to persuade his captors to try to reach us. Eventually, we received a call from the airport. I put on my most official-sounding voice and assured the person that I worked for Columbia Records and that, indeed, Mr. Johnson was being employed by us. That seemed to work because within another hour or so, a still-fuming Johnson arrived at Eaton's. Between the late-night sessions and another late-night evening, the next evening, he turned in a beautiful performance of the Hindemith Trumpet Sonata, and the project was underway. And Henry Charles Smith told me he also went over the piece over the phone with Gould. He said, one of the wonderful, neat things that happened before the recording, about a month before we got together, he called me late one night, and for about an hour and 15 minutes over the phone, we sang the Hindemith Trombone Sonata to each other, so we kind of had a rehearsal over the telephone. It was wonderful, it was very productive, and when we got together, it was as if we'd already had a very good rehearsal on it. He has his own unique way of recording and editing, and eventually we recorded the Hindemith Sonata, a 14-minute piece. We recorded 8 hours one night and 6 hours the next night. And he said that Gould picked him up in his old Cadillac with an overcoat and a scarf on, and it was a warm evening. And Henry Charles Smith said he was eccentric, but he was an honest eccentric because he was absolutely a genius. But if we could have a little bit of number six here. This is a little bit of the last movement of the tuba concerto. To play a spoken portion of one of these sonatas. This is the sonata for E flat alto horn, which was the piece that filled out the two record set in the original album version. And this is Mason Jones and Glenn Gould speaking. It's number 10.
Is not the sounding of a horn to our busy souls, even as the scent of blossoms wilted long ago, or the discolored folds of musty tapestry, or crumbling leaves of ancient yellowed tomes, like a sonorous visit from those ages which counted speed by straining horses' gallop and not by lightning prisoned up in cables. And when to live and learn they ranged the countryside, not just the closely printed pages. The cornucopia's gift calls forth in us a pallid yearning, melancholy longing.
The old is good, not just because it's past, nor is the new supreme because we live with it, and never yet a man felt greater joy than he could bear or truly comprehend. Your task it is, amid confusion, rush, and noise, to grasp the lasting, calm, and meaningful, and finding it anew to hold and treasure it.
That was, I guess it's the only recording ever made, wasn't it, with the where they used the voice section, you know?
I think somebody else has recorded these sonatas since then. But
Mason also played the alto horn sonata on an alto horn. He did not play it on a French horn. He played the French horn sonata on a French horn, then did the alto horn sonata. Frankly, I'm not a great fan of the Hindemith sonatas. I think he was the Ormandy of sonata writers. Needed a buck, write a sonata. And interestingly enough, Gould told me that he did not like the tuba sonata worth a darn. He thought it was the worst thing that the Hindemith wrote. And I'm kind of, as a tuba player, I shouldn't say this, but I'm kind of inclined to agree. You know, and I think what he did with the tuba sonata made it more palatable. It doesn't sound like the blah, 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 blah. You know, a lot of rubatos, he slowed down the second movement. About the only thing on that sonata, on that recording, that I can take credit for is in the last movement is a long cadenza. And that was me. The rest of it was Gould. I mean, it was all his ideas. And I think the guy was an incredible artist. Just a shame he was nuttier than a fruitcake. But,
of course, you didn't tell the best part about recording this. So you were having some dental problems.
The what?
Dental, your teeth.
Oh. I have a bridge, a permanent bridge on the front. That time I had a couple of little teeth that I'd had for years. And right before my wife and I were supposed to go up to Toronto, and incidentally, we drove up living in Ann Arbor. It wasn't that fine of much of a trip. Thing came loose. I said, oh, my God, how am I going to play? And I called various dentists around town. I picked them out of a phone book. Finally found one guy who could see me. And I always referred to him as Shaky, because his hand would come up. I said, what's he going to do to me? He said, I'm going to glue that in. He said, I can't do anything else. He said, and I would suggest that when you get to Toronto, you survive on soups, soft food, which I did. I lived on soup. I also changed mouthpieces. I found a mouthpiece had a big cushion on it, so it wouldn't be too much. The famous no pressure system. I recorded the whole sonata that way, and came home, got in the car, came back to Ann Arbor, and we were invited to a party that night at the home of the chairman of the breast department. Went home, I said, thank God that's over, and the damn thing fell out. It was quite an experience. I think some back.
There's a legend that the arrangements for the Christmas disc came from the Salvation Army.
What was that?
The arrangements for what?
The Christmas CD.
No.
What was that?
The arrangements from the CD were from the Salvation Army.
Salvation Army?
I thought Andy Kasdan did the 12 Days.
The 12 Days of Christmas were another little red books that they have in church. We used those.
You did use those. I thought you used the Robert King.
There was a little red books in church. Mm-hmm. Then there were a couple of them that were, I don't know where Andy got them, but 12 Days of Christmas, Andy Kasdan did. That was his arrangement. I thought it was a pretty darn good arrangement. But the way we worked, Gil Johnson was, in effect, our concertmaster. We would play through it on one of those little red books. I said, let's try it this way. How about the trombone and French horn and then this and that? Until we got what we felt was a reasonable sound, we recorded it. That was it. It was done very quickly, and it was a wonderful record. That's still very much for sale, too, on a CD. Incidentally, the Torchy Jones, I must tell you, I don't know if some of you may know Roger Blackburn, trumpet player from the Philadelphia Orchestra, who was quite, I guess, an audiophile, has a tremendous record collection. He bought himself a very expensive, what do you call it, a burner, to take records and make them into CDs. And I don't know how he got a hold of this. He has the original master tape from the Torchy Jones. He made CDs for all of us using this cover and the picture from Look magazine on the back, and it says for private use only. Sounds better than this. Sounds better than the original record. Wish they would put them out in the market again, but that's Sony Records.
Okay, I think we're out of time.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.